Welcome to Wildlife Rehabilitation from Rescue to Release, a podcast dedicated to licensed wildlife rehabilitators and the veterinarians who support them. I'm your host, Gail Buell.
Techniques we discuss here are meant for licensed wildlife professionals. If you aren't licensed and trained for wildlife rehabilitation, do not attempt to capture, hold, or rehabilitate any wild animal. If you find an injured wild animal, a wildlife professional can recommend next steps. We will tackle topics about rescue, care, management, reconditioning, and releasing wildlife found in North America. This is a deep dive into each subject. We hope to give rehabilitators information they can use because they're already going to great lengths to rescue and nurse animals back to health. There are three possible outcomes in wildlife rehabilitation: release, euthanasia, and placement. An injured or orphaned wild animal's journey to restored health and independence in their natural habitat is delicate and complex. We draw techniques and expertise from many disciplines. Many animals brought into rehabilitation cannot be saved. The last gift we can give them is humane euthanasia. We'll talk more about when this is necessary. Sometimes animals are deemed non-releasable and evaluated to be suitable for a life in captivity. When that happens, we shift to a long-term approach to managing their care, training, and housing. Some such animals serve as ambassador animals, a term for animals that rehabilitators use to educate the public. Each episode, we'll speak with experts who represent specialty topics across the profession of wildlife rehabilitation, ambassador animal care and management, showcasing best practices. Seals sure vocalize a lot, don't they? I don't know about you, but I can't get enough. Seals' behavior and natural history are fascinating. So are you ready for part two of my recent talk with Dr. Michelle Rivard and Casey McLean of SR3? If you're just joining us, in episode 9, I spoke with these two about how they came to be involved in rescuing marine mammals and what they're up to now. They walked me through their rehabilitation process from intake just up to release for harbor seals. Today in part two, we finish talking about the release process for harbor seals, then dive right into the details of another animal they encounter frequently, the California sea lion. You go out on a boat, open up the crate, wait for them to come out. Do you release them on the shore?
There you go.
And we're going to have to take one of the pictures that Casey just brought up with crates with the harbor seals with the doors open on shore and the harbor seals coming out. And I can see one of the harbor seals have a little red chip on top of his head. Okay, so that answers the question. And you're finding a beach and you're doing it right on the beach.
Yeah, there are some conditions where a boat release may be more appropriate. So if it's maybe an animal that's not a naive pup, or sometimes if there's an animal that restrands or we're concerned about habituation, then those may be better candidates for a boat release. But in general, our harbor seal pups that strand is a naive young animal, it's nice to be able to do those beach releases so that they can kind of come out of the carrier, take their time. We don't have to rush them into the water and into the surf. Mm-hmm. And then that's also something else that we look at is weather and water conditions. It's usually always raining up here, but we want to make sure that we're not putting these pups into, you know, a huge surge or some nasty waves, which the sound is typically, inside Puget Sound is typically calmer versus the outer coast of Washington.
Okay. Yeah, I suppose. I mean, do you look at the weather going out like 3 to 5 days or that kind of thing to say, hey, it's going to be relatively calmer? We don't have any big storms coming. Is that a consideration?
Yeah, to an extent, typically within Puget Sound, we're safe, but we do a little bit more planning on if we're on the outer coast of Washington, because the weather there can be, not quite as predictable and have some nasty waves and tides like that up there. So
okay. The tags, when you're tagging these guys before they get released, is it, do each one of those tags have a very unique
number kind of like bird banding? Is that how I should think about it? Or how should I think about it? Is it colored a particular way? Like you said, right side for females, left for males. Are they tags that are colored and you want them colored or you don't want them colored because we don't want, you know, predator spotting them? I mean, how does the tagging?
Yeah, they're orange tags, and you can actually see it in one of them in the background of Michelle's photo background there, little orange tags. There you go.
Oh, there we go. Uh-huh. Yeah. I may need that picture, too, so we can show everybody
what that is. We can do that. They have been red before, but typically all the ones that are coming out of rehabilitation are orange. They try and use different colors for other things, such as research projects or something like that. So, you know, often you aren't getting close enough to read the numbers on there, or they might be laying in such a position that prevents you from seeing all of the numbers. So sometimes the color can help. I will say on animals that have had tags for a long time, occasionally that color can fade. And what was once orange now becomes is that pink or is that,
right.
You know, other colors, or it can grow stuff on it sometimes that you're like, oh, that, what color is that? So they can get a little bit challenging out there for sure. But generally the orange ones are what we're using. And on the phocids, we're placing those in those rear flippers. And then on the otoriids, the sea lions or fur seals, we're placing those on those front flippers, kind of close to the armpit, I guess, for lack of where we'd say that goes.
I almost called it wing pits, but that's not exactly right.
I like it. Pits.
Mm-hmm. Wing pits.
So yes, hopefully those again will stay on for life so they can be seen. And there's definitely been a lot of respotting. I know California has lots of resites of their animals that have been released. Occasionally these animals might be outfitted with satellite tags, but of course that's a very expensive process. So typically that can be reserved for when you're looking at a research study with a certain number of animals and really, or maybe a unique case or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm going to keep going down this quote unquote rabbit hole of banding and tracking and things like that. Because when, let's say I'm out doing something and I spot our little baby harbor seal, with a tag, who do I report it to?
Yeah, we hope people report it for sure. Even if they see them with the little bingo chip, that's how most of ours have been recited, honestly, because a lot of harbor seals, you may not see those rear flippers. But if you do, and you happen to be able to read the number with binoculars or, you know, long lens or something, reporting that to the local stranding network is helpful. That there's one main 800 number that we can give you if you'd like to distribute that. And if you just call them and let them know, they will get that information to the appropriate group.
Oh, awesome. Yes, I will gather that number so we can put that in the show notes and things like that for folks. So it does lead to another question. One of the criticisms, and some of it's legitimate, on rehabilitation is you release them and they die. They're not, why are you doing this? It doesn't make any difference. You know, we've all heard that those types of arguments. So two-part question. What do you guys at SR3 and for marine mammals have as the bar to say this rehabilitation was a success? These are the things that we're looking for. And have you been able to get enough information, even if it's anecdotal, of the animals that you've released to say, what we do is not, we're not wasting time. We're not, yes, we work with individuals, but we are, we're a success when we're releasing. Michelle, do you want to take some of that?
I think one thing that's important to keep in mind when you're considering the conservation aspect for marine mammal rehab is, majority of the animals that we're rehabilitating are not threatened or endangered. Mm-hmm. And we are not even coming close to moving the scale when it comes to population numbers by releasing animals that come into care. But the reason that wildlife rehab is so important is marine mammals are really valuable sentinels to tell us what's going on in the wild. So we can learn a lot from every animal that comes through the door. Unfortunately, sometimes we learn more, most of the time, we learn more from the dead ones than the ones that make it out. But that's really valuable information. So we're talking about how there's the HPAI outbreak on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why the stranding network things like that exist, so that they can detect those diseases. Here on the West Coast, there are diseases like cancers that are spread through a herpes virus. There's leptospirosis. There are biotoxin or domoic acid blooms. So all of these either diseases or that we see in marine mammals or toxins that we see in the environment, we learn from animals that strand. And a lot of those diseases have been characterized by caring for rehabilitated marine mammals. And unfortunately, characterizing those diseases, those are usually the animals that didn't make it out of rehab. But I think that it's important that we think about and what we consider to be a success from a rehab standpoint, because we can still learn a lot from the animals that don't get released. Mm-hmm. As far as animals that do make it through rehab and get released, and there is some data in harbor seals, northern elephant seals, and California sea lions to suggest that about 50% of the animals released from rehab survive. Those are numbers from California, because we haven't had rehab long-term up here in the Pacific Northwest. Mm-hmm. But that's about on par with the survivability or mortality rates that we see in the wild. So about 50% survival. So if we can come pretty close to that with our rehabilitated animals, I think that's definitely a great goal to strive for. But we definitely need to do more post-release monitoring and satellite tagging to get a better idea of how long these animals survive after release.
Right. And as Casey mentioned, of course, the satellite tagging and everything, we know this in birds too, is incredibly expensive. It's not easy. And you need to have trained people to be able to interpret the data and, you know, create the study and all that kind of stuff so you can control some of the variables. I mean, it's more complicated than people think, I think, having been involved in a lot of monitoring of wildlife, not marine mammals, but other things. And, but it's certainly something that's very, very needed. But I really resonated with you saying that if we can approach the survivability of the wild, and I'm putting wild in quotes because the ones in captivity for rehabilitation are wild as well, but they're conspecifics. If 50% of those animals don't make it to adulthood in this particular case of our scenario, then if we're mimicking that, that's, I also think, is a success. We're not trying to make the ones we're releasing better, but we want to make them at least equal, right? Equal to the ones that are out there on their own. So,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. And one other important thing to consider is the information that we learn by caring for these animals, whether it's a California sea lion or a harbor seal, that can be applied to species that are endangered. So the Guadalupe fur seal, for instance, the husbandry and veterinary care to care for a Guadalupe fur seal is not unlike a northern fur seal, which is not endangered and we may see more of. And there's a lot of similarities between caring for a northern elephant seal and a Hawaiian monk seal. So being able to draw those parallels and having staff that are trained and are able to care for these animals. We really can't only rehab the endangered ones to be able to build that capacity and that knowledge and understanding. So that's something else that's really important that comes out of marine mammal rehab.
Well, and boy, I love that. That's also another kind of bridge that's similar in terrestrial or birds in particular. I'm reaching for that, but California condors. I mean, California mm-hmm. hunters, bald eagles, when they were an endangered species, we drew a lot of really good information from rehabilitation of the quote unquote common species. And that really helped a lot. It just jump started everything. You didn't have to learn it from scratch. So yeah, very good point.
Oh, sorry. One thing to tag onto that too, is that it prepares us in the event of a crisis. You cannot pop up a facility that's ready to help in the event of an oil spill or an unusual mortality event. You can't just say, okay, now we're ready to go for these particular species. A lot of things can be done for smaller animals, but, you know, having, as Michelle said, the trained staff, people who know how to handle these animals, because things like oil spills are not an if, they're a when. So being prepared for that sort of crisis is pretty critical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you're always supposed to be drilling anyway for things like those emergency responses, but this also just kind of on a different level just keeps you prepped a lot of the time. So it makes it the response even faster. Anything else we want to add to our little successful release of our little harbor seal?
No, I think he's out there swimming free now.
And eating all kinds of things. And
hope so.
And we're going to say it was a female. And no.
Sure.
Of course. And we thought, when we talked earlier, we thought about trying to kind of talk through, at least in brief, another species that might be different in some respects. Would there be another one that would be a really, really good one to highlight?
Yeah, I think one that is, especially from a natural history standpoint, and is rehabilitated frequently on the West Coast, though not so much in Washington, is the California sea lion. But before we veer away from harbor seals, I think one important thing to cover is to make sure that everyone has the National Marine Mammal Stranding Response Hotline and number.
Awesome.
So we can make sure to provide you that link and that number. So depending on the part of the country, if someone were to come across the stranded marine mammal, they have that information.
Yes.
But one thing that's particularly important, especially when it comes to harbor seal pupping season, is to make sure that if there is a harbor seal on the beach, that people keep their distance from it. So like we talked about, one of the main reasons that we get these pups in rehab is due to maternal separation or maternal abandonment. So we want to make sure that people stay as far away from those animals as possible. If there is a pup that looks like it's been abandoned, we want to make sure that we minimize disturbance in hopes that mom may come back, because moms do a much better job than we do. So that's important, especially as we get into pupping season, is to make sure that the public stays back from those animals, keeps their pets or their dogs away, and then has that national stranding response number to call if they do see a sick or injured or stranded marine mammal on the beach.
So before we go into like the California sea lion, here is something, a question for you. How can wildlife rehabilitators, especially, let's say Washington, because you guys are in Washington, help you with all this type of thing? Because if I'm walking my dog on the beach and I'm a finder, but I'm not associated with rehabilitation, and I see one of these animals that I think might need care, I may not know about the stranding hotline, right? But I may know that PAWS, which is in Seattle, is around. So I may call them, or maybe not even PAWS, because I know they do a small number of marine mammals, I believe. But maybe it's another rehabilitator that doesn't. And so how can rehabilitators then, yes, they can give the stranding hotline out. Anything else that rehabilitators can help you with? I mean, is there conservation messages? So like I'm in the middle of the country too. I'm talking about Washington rehabilitators, but I'm talking about Minnesota rehabilitators too. How can I help with marine mammals? I mean, not necessarily, I'm not talking about doing the actual rehabilitation.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things they could do is people get really frustrated when they call a number and give them another phone number. And while I think that's critical, you do have to give out that stranding hotline number. If the rehabilitators have at least some level of education, like you said, was the thing to at least let them know what to do as far as stay away, help people understand that maybe the animal isn't abandoned. So knowing some of that natural history to share with the PAWS right away, I think you kind of talk them off the ledge sometimes of being like,
yep,
I'm going to pick this baby up and help it, you know, while they wait for a call back from a stranded member. So I think that's a really big thing to do. And then, you know, SR3s really try to get out in the community and talk to our other, you know, wildlife rehabilitators that work with terrestrial animals so that they have a direct connection to us if they have questions, or finding they just kind of know the scenarios better and know that they can reach out to us for help. We can help them understand some of the basics and things like that. So building those relationships, I think, are really important too. If you're not in the middle of the country, or even if you are in the middle of the country, we can still give you that information. But
well, I was thinking, Right. I was thinking of me here in Minnesota, and most of my paid professional career has been in ambassador animals, right? So direct conservation education with the public. And one of my thoughts went, how can I, and we may not be able to answer this here exactly, but there are definitely ways to do it. We are always trying to teach that everything's connected, right? And so animals that are coming to Minnesota, especially birds, if they're migrating in the winter, they're down in the coast, on the coast of Florida or something like that. To me, that's a major connection, right? We want to try to connect those dots, and people in Minnesota might not be thinking about the ocean, but how can I help with that? So we may not have to answer that here, but that's where my brain goes is, you know, if we can help make the help, you know, through our conservation messaging, if we can help make the oceans healthier, then hopefully by default, the animals that live within those oceans should be healthier as well, and maybe not need as much assistance.
Well, all rivers lead to the ocean, right? So there's that sort of aspect. But I think also you mentioned the birds moving. Well, while the seals might not move from Seattle to Minnesota, your people do. So, you know, lots of people in the Midwest are vacationing in areas where they may encounter these animals. And so whether you're talking about harbor seals in particular, or maybe you're talking about sea turtles and dolphins, then when they hit the beach, or just marine mammals in general, they're going to encounter some marine species if they're vacationing in areas, you know, with beaches and on the ocean. So I don't think it ever hurts to put that kind of information out there. People who do frequent those places are likely to maybe attend a webinar if you're able to share when we're hosting those, so they can learn a little bit more, or putting stuff on your website where maybe people who are nature people who are looking at bird stuff might say, oh, what's this about marine mammals? I go to the beach every year. What should I know?
Oh, that's a great idea. And I love the thought. Of course, yeah, I've been to the coast many times because in the middle of the wintertime here, well, we won't go into that, but we want to get someplace where there's no snow. But that's a great point that birds are moving, but the people are moving too, back and forth and things like that. So, oh, excellent. Excellent. Thanks for letting me take that extra little jog. All right. So let's talk maybe briefly about California sea lions. How does that rehabilitation from beginning to end look a little different? We don't have to go through all the things that are similar, but how does that look?
Yeah, so I chose the California sea lion. Well, not only are they my favorite, but those are animals that strand really across age classes. So we more commonly see younger animals when we're talking about the harbor seals or the elephant seals, or even the northern or Guadalupe fur seals. California sea lions are a little bit more coastal and gregarious, so and they get sick with a lot of interesting things. So we tend to see them strand in higher numbers of pups, but it's not uncommon to have juveniles, subadults, and adults strand as well. So they have a different life history when you compare them to the harbor seal. So they're a migratory species. So a majority of the California sea lions will all congregate in the Channel Islands, which is off of Southern California, to breed and pup each year, usually between May and July, and they'll disperse. So the females will stay closer to the Channel Islands because they actually nurse their pups for 9 months, which is quite different than the harbor seal, right? That nurses for a month. So that impacts what types of animals we see in different parts of the country. So in California, especially Southern California, they'll see more females, more pups. And as you move north up the coast, you tend to see older animals and males. So juveniles, adults, and subadults. So up here in Washington, we really don't see any female California sea lions and very rarely see pups, but we do have a good amount of subadult and adult male California sea lion.
Okay.
So we have a harder time getting the public to call about them because they're big and they like to steal people's fish. So in general, people are take less to rehabilitation of California sea lions, but that doesn't mean that they're not stranding up here.
Okay.
So I guess I can pick one that we know has happened, at least somewhat recently. So one disease process that we'll see not uncommonly in California sea lions, especially in late summer and early fall as they disperse from the rookeries, is leptospirosis.
Okay.
So typically those animals will strand, they'll be in thinner body condition, really dehydrated. They may appear to be painful. So you'll see them on the, either on the beach or once they come into care with their flippers kind of straightened and their abdomen sort of tucked up, because that they can have a good amount of abdominal pain with that disease. Okay. Yeah. So that's, the, I guess I picked the question and the answer, didn't I? Was that cheating?
You did, and that's okay. That was great.
I guess, Michelle, you could probably speak to that, you know, these are big animals and sometimes they're not coming in and they might be entangled, and maybe a little bit of what we do with them in the field for that problem.
Yeah. So that is something else. So aside from leptospirosis, that is a disease that sometimes you can treat with supportive care. And sometimes, unfortunately, those animals have to be euthanized. But we do have the capacity to care for one. We just, again, have to get people to bring them to us. But something else that Casey mentioned that we'll see not uncommonly up here in the Pacific Northwest with both California sea lions and Steller sea lions is entanglement. So those animals can get entangled in different types of marine debris and fishing gear. In Washington specifically, packing straps, I believe, are the most common. And it varies from Washington to Oregon to California, because a lot of it is dependent on the local fisheries.
Wow, packing straps. And I was thinking fishing line and hooks and things and nets and things like that. But packing straps?
Well, yeah. And that's something that we see too. We definitely see fishing gear as well.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so those animals... Typically, it takes a long time for them to become compromised enough from those entanglements to be easy to catch or for them to strand.
Yep.
So something that we, well, really all along the coast is working towards towards remote sedation with these animals. So basically, that's using a dart gun to sedate them or anesthetize them from a distance, so that way we can handle these animals, remove the entangled gear. So those are definitely logistically complicated and require boats and an experienced team and a lot of things to come together, mm-hmm. And a lot of organization. But that is one of the tools that we sort of have in our toolkit to try and mitigate some of those human interaction cases that are entangled in marine debris. So because of the risks that come along with basically sedating an animal with a dart gun, the animals that we tend to focus on with those entanglements are what we call lethal entanglement. So those are animals that are entangled and we know that at some point it's going to cause them to die in one way or another, whether it's infection or decreased mobility that impacts their ability to forage. So those are the animals that we prioritize, the ones that are lethally entangled. And there's an entire process that you have to go through to become permitted for these types of activities. And also, if you're going to go out on a remote sedation or a disentanglement trip, you have to have prior authorization from NOAA and the stranding network coordinator to be able to conduct those kinds of activities. So it's a lot of coordination.
Right. Oh, sounds like it. Yeah. It takes a village.
It does.
It takes a village to do it and do it well and right and for the right circumstances and things like that. So that's real helpful, you know, like the differences and how, what you're seeing with the different species and things like that. I do want to talk, I'm going to say briefly, but I bet it's not going to be briefly, about permits. Because I have, as I do birds and a lot of terrestrial animals, and mammals and reptiles and things like that, I have a permit from the state of Minnesota, but I also have a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service permit. But I know that to do marine mammal work, there are several other layers of not only hoops on fire that you have to jump through, but permits that you need to get. So, Casey, do you want to explore that just a little bit?
Sure.
obviously our very first permit that we needed was with NOAA, National Marine Fisheries Service, since they are the ones that regulate for marine mammals. So mm-hmm. we had to work with them to, you know, while we were building the facility, they're reviewing plans. They do have a document that is rehabilitation standards. So we knew exactly, like, how big does the dry dock need to be? How big does the pool need to be for this size of animal? How many animals can we keep in there? All of those same regulations that, at least for Washington, typically come from the state when you're talking about birds and other terrestrial animals.
Right.
Our state kind of just literally in the thing, it says, you know, marine mammal regulations, see NOAA. So <Right. laughs> they kind of leave that all up to them since we have those standards established. So we were able to get that permit. And then once we had the facility built, they came in and did an inspection, make sure everything looks good. And then I was also permitted by WDFW, Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, for my rehabilitator's state license. So I have that license as well. And then we have, you know, our permit through NOAA is what's called our rehabilitation permit. It does state in there that if we need to respond in the field, we are able to do that. Typically, we're doing that in collaboration with those people we talked about earlier, the other stranding network partners.
Okay. Okay.
And then Michelle has her own set of permits.
Yeah. So there's additional permitting that's required to care for ESA or endangered species.
Okay.
So that rehab permit covers most of the species that we work with, but in order to rehabilitate Guadalupe fur seal, that's an additional step in permitting. So that's through NOAA.
Okay.
As well as any of the remote sedation work that requires an additional permit as well.
Right.
And something that's a matter of confusion quite frequently is that covers most marine mammals, so pinnipeds, but to rehabilitate sea otters as well as sea turtles, you have to go through U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So the permitting agencies vary depending on species. So while NOAA covers a majority of marine mammals, sea otters are still technically considered a marine mammal and a species that we can care for here, as well as sea turtles. Okay. But that's a different agency that grants those permits.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, lots of hoops, lots of permits. A lot of permit reports, all those kind of necessary things. So, wow. I'm going to turn just a little bit more to SR3 itself. So how many animals in general, you know, I know it varies from year to year depending on what's happening out in the world, but about how many animals do you see at the center per year?
You want me to answer?
Yeah.
Let's see.
I mean, it could be a general number.
About 50 or so.
Okay.
50 to 60.
50 to 60.
I would say.
But remember, we only have 2 years.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's, yeah. It's going to go up. And then some years it will be a little lower and it'll go up. But yeah, you've only got a few years really into this. So, I mean, it's not an enormous amount of individuals. However, each one takes an enormous amount of care. And a lot of resources, an incredible amount of resources to be successful. So how many staff, interns, volunteers does it take to do this?
We have nine. Yep, we have nine full-time staff, and that can include anyone from myself and Michelle to we have a communication specialist, we have an outreach coordinator, we have, you know, fundraiser. So a little bit of varied staff. And then volunteer-wise, I think we're about between 70 and 80 active volunteers. Mm-hmm. It's a quite, you know, an in-depth training process, much as you experience with the terrestrial side of things. Mm-hmm. We really want to get folks involved, but also make sure that they're comfortable and know what they're doing. So, and then there's all of the Stranding Network partners that we work with, which often are volunteers for those other Stranding Networks. So again, more volunteers that we're working with. So. Mm-hmm. Like all rehabilitation, we definitely rely on volunteers to be able to do what we do and help as many animals as we have.
Right. Yeah, again, takes a village. Definitely takes a village, for sure. If someone was really interested in getting involved in marine mammal rehabilitation, either starting a facility like you did, Casey, or eventually getting a job working at a facility. Are there pieces of advice you'd give? Are there, I mean, because it definitely is a crooked path that, you know, we all seem to take to get to our current careers and passions, but are there things that you would suggest?
As far as starting a facility, I don't recommend it. Almost killed me. No, that is very challenging. No, I'm just kidding. It's a passion. It's well worth it. Anything you decide to do in the marine mammal world. But I think from my perspective, and I know Michelle can talk about from the veterinary, being a veterinarian aspect, but I really fell in love with the husbandry and the medical care and side of things. And so I think I did a lot of internships in college and out of college. I realized that is a huge privilege that I got to do because they were unpaid internships. And I know that's not possible for a lot of people. We're starting to see facilities be able to provide some sort of stipend. Mm-hmm. SR3 tries to do that as well. But hopefully that'll increase in the future for everybody. But I think volunteering and internships are massively important when you're looking at getting into this because having that hands-on experience is very critical. I also think that while it's a small enough field that networking and who you know can really help you find those opportunities. Mm-hmm. So taking the time to go to those conferences, there's some student conferences that are fantastic to go to if you happen to be on the coastlines, mostly, of course.
Sure.
Those are always great. But yeah, Michelle, if you want to speak to it from the vet side of things.
Yeah, I think one of the things that can really set people apart if they're interested in veterinary medicine or biology is also research. So aside, like Casey said, getting that hands-on experience and understanding how to care for these animals is really important, but also understanding that, the reason that we rehabilitate them is to learn from them and to keep moving the field forward. So if you can get any sort of research experience, even if it's not directly related to marine mammals, then that will definitely set you apart if you're looking to get into veterinary school or a career after veterinary school or a career in as a biologist, marine mammal biologist or something like that. Having the research background and maybe some publications can really set you apart as well.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Like you said, it's still a relatively small field. So I bet you all know each other very well.
Yes. It's also don't make anybody mad. That's very important.
I love it. Yep. If you go in as a volunteer or as an intern or even as a job, and if you're interested in that field, do a good job. Show up on time.
Yeah. I was going to say that's something that is really treat any internship and maybe even any volunteer position too. Like it's a job interview. That's honestly where we've hired a lot of our people from is people that were either past interns or current or past volunteers.
Yeah, and I've called it that too, is that it is like it's a job interview. It just is a really long one. But yeah, people pay attention. And I've certainly done that as well. If I've got, you know, someone who is volunteering and doing a really good job, and they don't necessarily have to go above and beyond, but they're doing a good job. And yeah, then they're the ones I might reach for when we're looking for presenters or things like that. So I think that's really, really good advice. Anything else we haven't covered that you're like, oh my gosh, I really want to share this information? I don't know what I don't know. So that's the, I just don't know if we covered something.
We talked about permits and stuff, but I guess I want to make sure we're real clear on, you know, wildlife rehabilitators who are even permitted by their state, they're not covered for marine mammals. So if there's something going on where someone shows up on your doorstep with a seal in their arms.
Oh, yeah.
That's the time where folks who that can be a potential, that's really critical that you have a connection with either a local marine mammal facility or your local stranding network so that you have someone to call if that happens.
Right.
Because it has happened at facilities around here.
And that makes sense, right? Same thing with my scenario. I'm walking down the beach. Who am I going to, you know, if I know of a local rehabilitator, that's who I'm going to reach out to first. So that's a really, really good point. Just having that information, not just for telephone, but if someone shows up at your door, you need that information too.
Yeah. And not to say you can't take the animal from their possession, of course. but it's just one of those things where you want to know who you can call immediately. What am I allowed to do? What should I do? Who can help?
Right, right. And most rehabilitators do not have any experience with marine mammals. So I'd be like on the phone within seconds. Help me. What do I do?
But well, like, outside of...
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Michelle.
Oh, no. I was just going to say, outside of calling that national hotline, well, we can send you the NOAA website that details all of the stranding regions in the country. Oh, and if you click on the state you're in on that map, it'll show you every, so Washington has, I'm looking at the map right now. There's a lot of
don't count them.
I would say 15 or so different responders in the state. So it can get a little complicated, but if you're a wildlife rehabilitator in that area, it really will probably benefit you to take a little bit of time, look at this map and be like, oh, okay, this is who I should probably be calling if I'm in this region.
Right. And my guess is that even if they call, you know, a number that's not the exact person that they need to get a hold of, that person can say, no, you need to get a hold of this person or direct you in the right.
Exactly.
So excellent. Thank you so much for today. Yeah, I so appreciate this. When I had the chance to visit last fall, I'm like, oh, this is something we need to talk about more. I was just eating it up. It was just wonderful. And of course, a subject I know, like I said, very little about. So this is for me just as much as it is for all the people who are tuning in and listening. So I want to thank Dr. Michelle Rivard and Casey McLean again from SR3 for talking with us today about marine mammal rehabilitation and all the kind of the ins and outs. I have had a phenomenal time, and I just really, really appreciate you taking the time to spend with us. So thank you.
Thank you. We've enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, thank you for chatting with us, Gail. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Wildlife Rehabilitation from Rescue to Release, Season 2. That was the second and final part of my recent discussion with Dr. Michelle Rivard and SR3 co-founder Casey McLean. I hope we managed to boost your pinnipin knowledge and that you enjoyed our first talk about marine mammal rehabilitation. Wildlife Rehabilitation from Rescue to Release is a production of Partners for Wildlife, working hand-in-hand with wildlife rehabilitators and veterinarians to improve the welfare of orphaned, ill, and injured wildlife. Our executive producer is me, Gail Buell. I'm the Partnership Coordinator for Partners for Wildlife at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine's Raptor Center. To learn more about the Raptor Center and Partners for Wildlife, visit raptor.umn.edu. Our producer is Kirk Clocky. Special thanks to our guests, Dr. Michelle Rivard and Casey McLean, SR3, Partners for Wildlife, and the Raptor Center at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine. And that's our show. Hope you'll join us again next time.